The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince? They exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.
I'm Benjamin Wittes, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, November 9th, 2023. Today, we are bringing you an episode of our podcast, Chatter, our forum for long-form conversations on culture, history, science, and other stuff in connection with national security. While we normally run Chatter on Thursday afternoons as a kind of bonus episode on the Lawfare podcast feed, this one was special, so we thought we would just make it the regular Lawfare podcast for today. Enjoy. This week on Chatter, Rachel Maddow discusses her new book, Prequel, An American Fight Against Fascism.
One of the things that I find most chilling in this story from the 40s is the Justice Department caving to political pressure and removing prosecutors, not because of things they did wrong, but because they stumbled into investigations that implicated powerful people. I think that's very, very dangerous. You know, the January 6th investigation in Congress doesn't result in prosecutions directly. You know, it doesn't put people in jail, but it does tell this story. And it does make the truth known. It prevents revisionist history. I want these heroes, Dillard Stokes and all the rest of them. I want this heroism to be known. And even if it wasn't known in their lifetime, I want us to learn from it.
I want to start with the relationship between the book and the podcast from which it emerged. For some listeners, this book may seem like it comes out of nowhere. All of a sudden, Rachel Maddow's writing about the history of fascism in America in the 30s and early 40s, and has done serious deep dives in criminal cases that had been long forgotten. But this is actually part two of a project. So walk us back to the Ultra Project and how you got interested in this subject.
So I was really interested in something that was coming up in contemporary politics, which is the moment that we're having in terms of the right and what you might characterize as the ultra-right in terms of the Trumpist movement within the Republican Party. And at the same time, we were seeing what we used to call the alt-right. I don't know if we're supposed to call them anymore, but essentially neo-Nazi, very anti-Semitic, very edgy, violent, anti-democratic movements outside electoral politics, and seeing those things coming up together. And I was not curious, but sort of worried about what was going on in electoral politics and also seeing that rise in anti-Semitism, neo-Nazi stuff, and Holocaust denial. And Holocaust denial is, among all the terrible things it is, one of the things that I've always thought about it is that it's just strange. It's a strange set of beliefs, given all the documentation there is of the Holocaust. And so I started looking at what are the American origins of that? What's the sort of American prehistory of Holocaust denial? What other sorts of political movements have been alive in the country at a time when Holocaust denial has been ascendant. And I ended up getting as far back as like 1948 in terms of the earliest instances that I could find of American Holocaust denial, which is very strange, right? 1948, there are a lot of people who can personally testify to the events of the Holocaust. How can it possibly be that people are saying it didn't happen? Well, it was part of a larger political project. They didn't earnestly believe that the Holocaust didn't happen. They were propounding that for a different reason. And once I got into that weird history, I stumbled into the Great Sedition Trial of 1944 and all of these Americans who sided with the Germans in World War II, who in some cases worked for Germany, and then this German agent who was running a plot with 24 members of Congress, the failed court cases around a number of those plots and instances. And I didn't expect to stumble on all that, became fascinated with it and decided to tell that story. So the Ultra podcast really focuses, as you know, on two trials, on the Sedition Trial in 1940 against the Christian Front, which was a ultra-right paramilitary group, and then the Great Sedition Trial in 1944, which was nearly 30 defendants all in the same courtroom all at once. Both of those prosecutions failed. That was sort of the story of Ultra, but I wanted to tell the story of those movements and how influential and powerful they were in American politics more broadly with more characters. And that's what I did in the book.
One thing that is super interesting about the book, and it you tease it in the podcast as well, is how comparatively small a role the criminal justice process plays in the defeat of these movements relative to a kind of whole of society response to them. You spend a lot of time in the book talking about the Washington Post, talking about, and a particular reporter there. You spend a lot of time talking about a guy who does direct mail advertising and has a newsletter about it, who discovers this pattern of propaganda mailings and kind of unravels it. And, you know, I'm interested in this because, once again, the title of the book is Prequel. And the reason for our interest in this subject now, of course, is that it has something to do with our contemporary reality. But once again, we are all getting deeply wrapped up in the criminal process as our salvation here. We did it with Mueller. We did it with, you know, the pre-Mueller Russia investigation. And now we have indictments and it's all very exciting. And God knows I'm spending all my time covering these cases. And yet part of me looks at your book and says, hey, the moral of the story here is that the criminal process has a role to play in this, but it is not a substitute for the societal reckoning that in this case happened because we had World War II. Mm-hmm. And right, that what really defeated the America First Committee was Pearl Harbor. And so I'm interested in, before we get into the details, you know, the Bob Mueller figure, Jack Smith figure of that time is your great character, Ojan Raji, who's a genuine hero and a tremendous failure in every real, like he was good enough to bring down the Huey Newton, the Huey Long organization, but not, couldn't take on successfully domestic Nazis. Are we over investing in the criminal process?
I'm so glad that you focused in on that, because I think it's definitely one of the key revelations that I experienced personally in working on this. And I feel like it's one of the most resonant things in terms of how it makes me think about today's news. I mean, to cut to the chase, I mean, I think the bottom line is that the criminal justice system and the criminal legal process is necessary but not sufficient. I do think it's important that when there are crimes, they are prosecuted as crimes. And one of the hallmarks of a democracy that's in danger is that you've got violence encroaching on what should be the political space. Violence is always a crime and you should treat it as a crime. And the criminal justice system can't absent itself from prosecuting acts of violence or intimidation or threats just because those things are motivated by some larger political project. I really believe that is true. And I equally believe that the criminal justice system cannot do any of this on its own. And so, you know, looking back at this era that I covered in Prequel and also in the podcast Ultra, there's, for example, the story of the German-American Bund. And most of what I'm interested in the book is native-grown, not German-American diaspora fascism, but the Bund was German-American diaspora fascism. They were linked to the Nazi Party in Germany. They were engaged in some arguably seditious stuff. They were engaged in violent plots and working with other paramilitary groups. There's all sorts of problems in terms of what the Bund was doing. They were also doing just all this deeply creepy stuff like running Hitler Youth summer camps all over America. But ultimately, the head of the German-American Bund got arrested and prosecuted and deported back to Germany for embezzling from that organization. Now, was the biggest problem in the German-American Bund that they had Fritz Kuhn embezzling from their fund? No. And did his arrest and prosecution and deportation under those terms define the end of that organization or the ultimate confrontation with what that organization was doing? No. It was essentially a sort of sideshow in terms of the accountability and the opposition that they faced. Similarly with the Christian Front, similarly with the sedition trial defendants in 1944. What Raggi did as prosecutor was fail, basically, in the courtroom. But the larger story of what he did is that those investigations and those prosecutions had the effect of airing out for the public what those organizations were doing, what those members of Congress were involved in, what those congressional staffers were involved in, what those Nazi agents were doing. And it had a benefit. It didn't work in the courtroom. He had a huge fight with the Justice Department as to whether or not to publicize his findings in an official Justice Department report. He was fired for arguably breaking Justice Department policy, arguably for political reasons. The criminal justice system is a piece. It's a piece of it, but it can't do everything. And journalism, activism, and institutions standing up for their own values, institutions, everything from the military to the church to the legal profession, all standing up, all matters in some cases just as much.
Yeah. So let's follow that and break down this conversation by category of societal organization. It seems to me that the organization that most failed, if you think about it from a sedition investigation point of view, is the FBI.
Yep.
And which is at the time, of course, run by J. Edgar Hoover, deeply trusted by President Roosevelt, and is actually asked to look into this stuff. Roosevelt is concerned, and Hoover does very little at first, to the point that, and I didn't know this until I read the book, that naval intelligence is effectively picks up some of the slack. Give us your impressions of the FBI's failure in this space.
It's a really interesting dynamic, and it is more, in some ways, more complex and also more small and petty than I expected. Some of what happened in the FBI was very much personality driven and jealousy driven, and it just like catty and petty in a very junior high school sort of way. There was a star agent named Leon Thoreau who played an important role in breaking up a Nazi saboteurs ring, Nazi spies, people actually sent over from Germany. And that became a big story. It became a big newspaper story. It became fodder for Hollywood. And J. Edgar Hoover was very jealous of that and didn't want Leon Thoreau to be a famous G-man. J. Edgar Hoover wanted himself to be the only famous G-man. He fired Thoreau over that. Thoreau ended up moving to Europe and having a very interesting end to his career after being probably the most famous figure in the FBI other than Hoover. I think that actually played an interesting role. that had some interesting spillover into how entities like Hollywood ended up portraying the Nazi threat and the sort of fifth column threat and the native fascist threat in this country. So there was some of it like that, which was just interesting human drama. But then there was also the ideological cant of the FBI, which was very much eyes left in terms of the threat. And that was true for federal law enforcement. That was also true for local law enforcement. And so some of the real drama and some of the real heroics that you learn about in this period are from individuals like Leon Lewis, who was running what was in effect a private spying operation for the ADL, for the Anti-Defamation League in Southern California, where he was running a spy group of spies, mostly German-American World War I veterans, who infiltrated pro-Nazi and native fascist groups. They produced incredible written documentation of what those groups were up to. They tried to interest local and federal law enforcement in it. The FBI told them they weren't interested. The LAPD, San Diego Sheriff, other local law enforcement told them they weren't interested. Leon Lewis, as you mentioned, was able to get naval intelligence interested in it, I think in part because he had proven himself to them. A couple of U.S. Marines had been court-martialed, actually, on the basis of Lewis's information about Marines who were stealing U.S. military weapons and providing them to some of these fascist groups. But it was so catch-as-catch-can just because law enforcement didn't want to believe that the threat was from the right. Law enforcement didn't want to believe that the basic, I think, worldview of the fascist groups was either incorrect or dangerous. The anti-Semitic worldview, the anti-communist worldview, and the pro-fascist worldview were widely shared by law enforcement figures low and high. And the people who were fighting these guys were really up against that in a very overt way.
So I think there's actually I agree with all of that. I think there's another dynamic that is subtly important in the 30s, which is that, you know, the sympathy in law enforcement for right-wing racists, which of course goes back, you know, quite a ways and, you know, has its own Southern origin, you know, as a sort of, you know, post-Civil War reaction. The relationship between the Klan and lots of local PDs, et cetera. None of this has an overseas lilt until the 30s, right? That, you know, you think about, so if you're J. Edgar Hoover, you think of, first of all, who was in fact himself a vicious racist. You have a certain sympathy with the worldview and you don't look at these people, you see these people as sort of local good old boys, not people who are in fact being controlled and operated by a foreign government. Whereas your nativism and, you know, your sense of overseas threat is super, super consistent with your anti-left bias. And so every local communist is being run by Moscow, but every local fascist is just some good old boy who maybe roughed somebody up or something, rather than you're not seeing the Bund in every local German American organization the way every Russian organization is common turn.
Yes. And it's totally true. Totally. I completely agree.
So you've flagged here two organizations that start filling the gap. One is civil society, and the portrayal of Leon Lewis is really remarkable. I mean, this is somebody who is completely lost to history and is actually an incredibly courageous and capable character in running effectively a private intelligence operation. But there's another actor that steps up in a way that I think is really interesting, and that is the much maligned House Un-American Activities Committee,
yes,
which, you know, we think of in connection with Red Scares, particularly in the post-war environment. But they did some creditable work here exposing German activity in Washington. So let's recreated as a historical character, Leon Lewis. Let's how much are you willing to do in burnishing the reputation of the much maligned House Un-American Activities Committee?
Do I have a Martin Dies impression that I want to bring to the table here? I mean, it is very interesting that you've got the Un-American Activities Committee, which of course is nascent in the 1930s, and they do some, as you say, creditable work here. They do some very early work talking about how the Germans are propagandizing the U.S. public. They do some later in the 30s, they do some work about these native fascist groups and violent plots that they're involved in that are potentially seditious. You do get the sense when you look at the work of that committee and the work of those members of Congress in toto that they also are eyes left. They also believe that communism is the only real threat. They also have their own fascist sympathies in some cases, anti-Semitic inclinations, racist inclinations. That's the way they're oriented. And so they'd prefer to be doing their work blowing up, you know, left-wing plots all over the country. But these damn fascists keep marching into the frame. You keep getting, I mean, there's very large American native fascist groups that keep getting caught, like, I don't know, stockpiling bombs and planning mass assassination terrorist attacks against Congress and, you know, stealing U.S. military weapons and working with Nazi agents and traveling back and forth to Germany and clearly being funded by the Nazi Party in Germany. Like what was happening was so big and in some cases so obvious in terms of its threat that it was begrudging, I think, on the part of the Un-American Activities Committee. But I will also say that once again, you get back to civil society, you get back to the ADL, you get back to the World Jewish Congress, you get back to other Jewish American groups that were forming their own intelligence operations to try to defend Jewish communities in the United States. And they were producing actionable intelligence that the government had a hard time ignoring. And so some of the people who gave the most dramatic testimony at Un-American Activities Committee hearings in the 30s were people who had become spies, effectively, who had infiltrated these groups, either because they worked for newspapers that were funding them to do it, or because they worked for Jewish groups that the Jewish communities had organized themselves to try to protect themselves against these groups and expose what they were doing. And they sort of dragged the government along with them.
It's interesting, though, that one of the striking features of the journalists that you talk about is that they are pretty uniformly not Jewish.
Yes.
And the civil society activism is a whole bunch of Jewish groups and a Jewish World War I vet organizing German World War I vets, which, you know, warms my ecumenical heart.
Yes.
But the journalism is this weird motley collection of diggers. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you have this incredible account of the investigation by a Minnesota journalist who is as white bread as they come of the Silver Shirt movement. And then there's this weird guy from Philadelphia who's in the sort of direct advertising mail business. So what can we say about the journalism here? Was this just people who caught a bug? Did they have something in common that made them want to hunt Nazis? You know, what'd you learn about this group of people put together?
This is the most just unqualified, joyful part of this story, because these people are all so interesting and because it is, I think, a real tribute to journalism just as a profession, because they're all so different. So in Minnesota, the guy you're talking about, we go on to know as the famous CBS commentator Eric Severide. Before he was going by his middle name, Eric, he was going by Arnold Severide, and he was a Cub reporter. He was working in Minneapolis. He had heard that there was sort of a weird secret society in middle class and upper middle class homes in Minneapolis, and he decided to go undercover and infiltrate them and discovered this guy who was positing himself as the American Hitler, who had a weird pseudo-occult, very anti-Semitic, very apocalyptic worldview, and had somehow persuaded thousands of people in Minneapolis alone and tens of thousands of people around the country to arm themselves, to form paramilitary cells and to join his organization. That was Eric Sevareid in Minneapolis. You had Dillard Stokes of the Washington Post, who was just kind of a badass city beat reporter who had an editor who was interested in him chasing down some intrigue that seemed to derive from a grand jury investigation of the propaganda stuff that seemed to be happening involving members of Congress.
And you don't mention this in the book, but I think it's actually important that this is the period right after Eugene Meyer buys the old Washington Post, which is sort of a right-wing newspaper, and creates out of it the Post that eventually becomes the crusading Watergate Washington Post, right? This is the very beginning of that process, in the first decade of the Graham family, Eugene Meyer owning that paper.
Yeah, and this, the Dillard Stokes investigations, the Dillard Stokes reporting trail, which is so dramatic and so fascinating, and which he got in so much trouble for on Capitol Hill. I mean, they were talking about, you know, not just subpoenaing him, but, you know, jailing Stokes, jailing his editor, bringing the publisher in to testify in Congress. I mean, the pushback was incredible. But this was at a time when the Post was not influential. It was not the biggest paper in Washington. They were still on their way. And this aggression that they showed, it's interesting to think, you know, if Dillard Stokes had worked at a different paper, would that reporting have gone the same direction that it did? Because he was fearless and the blowback was incredible. You also had a guy like John Metcalf, who worked for one of the Chicago tabloids, who had grown up speaking German at home and was, by his family's account, a total daredevil, just an absolute risk addict. And he jumped at the chance as a Chicago tabloid reporter to, you know, put on the brown shirt and the Nazi armband and go full undercover with all these Nazi groups, and did some incredible reporting along with his brother, who was also involved in this stuff. There was also a guy named, whose pen name was John Roy Carlson, whose real name was Arthur Derunian, who was an Armenian American who went undercover. He wrote a book called Undercover. It was the best-selling book in America in 1943, this incredibly dramatic story. Investigative tale about all of the native fascist groups and the links between them. So there's just all of these heroic journalists who all came from different backgrounds, you know, ethnographically, came from different types of the journalism world, tabloid, serious broadsheet, investigative journalism, book length, magazine reporters. And the stuff that they turned up ended up opening the American people's eyes to this in a way that then called on our democratic traditions for the public to respond. But the exposés that ran in all different kinds of journalistic entities, to me, are still exciting, inspiring, and I feel like it's part of the book that feels like a real instruction manual for what we ought to be doing today.
Yeah, and I also think the other, while we're talking about instruction manuals, the other part is a little discussion at the end of the electoral fallout that we're going to come back and talk about the villains here in a minute. But there's a lot of members of Congress involved in the bad stuff, and none of them goes to prison. None of them is convicted. None of them, you know, if we're thinking about the criminal justice process, the process available to deal with this problem as a criminal matter was essentially zero. And yet they do lose. And they, you know, they are not people who, they were very prominent in their day and they ceased to be. And I wonder if we are, if electoral rebuke is a much more powerful weapon here than we sometimes think it is.
Yes. And it is the reward. I mean, if you're looking at this in a terms of utilitarian way, it shows the payoff for all the activism and all the journalism and everything else that everybody did in civil society to expose what they were doing. I think that one of the things, looking back at this as a historical project, one of the things that's hardest to convey is that the people involved here who, in electoral politics, were very famous and very influential. And it's hard to convey that because their names are not familiar now. And that is by that is a product of the fact that they were voted out. People who get voted out of office, people who end up disgraced in office, end up often erased from history. I mean, there aren't that many Benedict Arnold figures in American history. Once you're a bad guy and you're rebuked for it and you lose because of it, you tend to disappear. There's a reason nobody remembers Spiro Agnew as Richard Nixon's vice president, for example. But if you can go back in history and see them as they were viewed in their time, it is striking how influential and what a big deal they were. I mean, Gerald Nye was seen as presidential timber for sure. He was an absolute institution in the United States Senate, but he was implicated in the Nazi plot in Congress. He, in fact, had during the sedition trial, the defendants and their lawyers every week would meet in Gerald Nye's office to plot their strategy. This was all outed. This was all exposed in the press at the time, and he was voted out in 1944. Hamilton Fish, who's only remembered now because his name is hilarious, was the sort of scion of one of the most famous and accomplished American political families. He had been in Congress for 24 years and was seen as totally unbeatable. But in 1944, after a campaign that focused almost entirely on his ties to this Nazi plot and this Nazi agent and the Nazi government, he was voted out. It was inconceivable that Hamilton Fish would ever lose that seat, but he lost that seat. Burton Wheeler, who was arguably Harry Truman's best friend in the Senate, who had enough weight to throw around that he got not one, but two prosecutors fired from the U.S. Justice Department for working on this story. Burton Wheeler was himself voted out in 1946. Again, inconceivable that he'd be voted out because he was so powerful, so influential, and such an institution. And those guys, and they aren't all of them. Most of the people who were implicated in this stuff in their time were voted out. There were only a very few of them who survived it. And that electoral rebuke, as you put it, to me is instructive. It is worth remembering. And it is, I think, worth keeping in mind in terms of the motivation, the purpose, the point of exposing this stuff. It, you know, the January 6th investigation in Congress doesn't result in prosecutions directly. You know, it doesn't put people in jail, but it does tell this story. And it does make the truth known. It prevents revisionist history, and it alerts the American people as to what their elected officials were up to. And that is important.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. United Healthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number smart beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number limited edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
Hey, Lawfare listeners, Ben Wittes here. Want to tell you about the first time I got a report from the folks at Delete Me. It was shortly after I started using the service back in 2022, and they sent me their first privacy report. I have since gotten 8 others, and it contained some shocking information. They had removed my data from 56 separate data brokers. that this had included 133 separate records, including 621 individual pieces of personal information. The data broker with the most information about me was a company I'd never heard of called People by Name. And here's the thing. Since then, every couple of months, I've gotten another privacy report from Delete Me, and it always contains more information that they have removed from the data brokers about me. In the second report, they informed me they had removed my stuff from 41 data brokers and that the one with the most information about me was called Hleck. I have no idea what Hleck is. So the other day, I got my latest report and it includes 15 more data brokers with my personal information, 113 pieces of personally identifiable information. Big culprit this time is something called My Life. Well, I want to tell you that they don't have My Life anymore. And that is why I recommend Delete Me. As this little anecdote shows, there's a lot of my data out there. And these companies keep acquiring it and making it available to anybody who can pay. And I have slept a little bit more easily ever since I found a solution to this problem. And I want to stress, as I do every time, that I started using this before Delete Me started advertising with Lawfare. Delete Me finds and removes any personal information you don't want online, and it makes sure it stays off. And that's the point of this little story, that, you know, they keep coming back. You can get it removed once, but they'll put it back. And then Delete Me comes and takes it off again. It's a subscription service that removes your personal information from the largest people search databases on the web, and in the process helps prevent potential identity theft, doxing, and phishing scams. Delete Me sends you regular personalized privacy reports, just like the ones I've been describing, showing what info they found where they found it, and what they removed. And critically, as this story reflects, it isn't just a one-time service. It's always working for you, constantly monitoring and removing the personal information you don't want on the internet. It does all the hard work of wiping you and your family's personal information off the web. Data brokers hate Delete Me, which is why I like it. Your profile is no longer theirs to sell. So take control of your data and keep your private life private by signing up for Delete Me, now at a special discount for our listeners. Today, get 20% off your Delete Me plan when you go to joindeleteme.com/lawfare20 and use promo code lawfare20 at checkout. The only way to get 20% off is to go to joindeleteme.com/lawfare20 and enter code LAWFARE20 at checkout. That's joindeleteme.com/LAWFARE20, code LAWFARE20. All right, so one thing this outcome required in 1941 was the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor. And a second thing that it required, which people forget about, is that 5 days after the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor, the German Reich declared war on the United States, not the other way around. Yes. And thereby solved a problem that Roosevelt had been struggling with, which is how do you enter the war in Europe? And the answer is, well, the Europeans solve that problem for you. Mm-hmm. I have no doubt that if Vladimir Putin tomorrow declared war on the United States and we found ourselves in a giant conventional war worldwide, the universe of people who were engaged in this activity domestically over the last few years would be discredited rather quickly, and you would have an electoral bloodletting. But I'm curious for your thoughts on what does all this exposure do in the absence of the ability, you know, in the absence of that cataclysmic event? You know, we all this stuff about the America First Committee was exposed and it chugged along just fine until,
you know, December 7th. And that seems to me more or less consistent with the January 6th committee does its thing. The story is out there for anybody who wants to know. And 50% of Americans don't care. And electorally, we're not looking at a, you know, bloodbath for the Trumpist. So does it require a cataclysm and a sort of outside enemy? Or is there some mechanism by which this stuff would have amounted to the rebuke it did even without that?
Unknowable, I think. In total, I think it's unknowable. But it's also it's kind of the inherent truth of this, Ben. I mean, I feel like if the point here, big picture, is democracy defending itself against those who would undo democracy, either by violent military attack or by subverting democracy and turning us to a different form of government. Well, the way a democracy defends itself is by democratic means. And so there isn't a silver bullet. There isn't any one thing. There's no magic disqualification spell that you can cast over your enemies that makes everybody realize the same thing at the same time and that makes them disappear as the kind of enemy that you don't want to face anymore. I also feel like we have to be alert to the ways that these things work both domestically and internationally. You have to face them where they confront you. So, you know, if it's fascism and other forms of authoritarianism that are militarist and expansionist and waging war around the world, then you beat them by beating them on the battlefield. And if it is anti-democratic movements at home that are trying to convince the American people that democracy is over and weak and no longer appropriate for us as a country, it's not the way that we should fix our problems anymore, then you have to meet them on that battlefield too. And you need to make the case to the American people and that democracy is the way that we should govern our country and insist that our democracy meet the problems that we do have and show itself to be up to the task of the challenges that we face right now. And, you know, and if there's violent paramilitary groups operating on the bloody edges of our politics, they need to be prosecuted. They also need to be infiltrated and exposed and discredited. Like it just all has to happen. And I don't think there's an easier answer than that. I do feel like there are some cautionary tales from previous fights like this. I mean, one of the things that I find most chilling in this story from the 40s is the Justice Department caving to political pressure and removing prosecutors, not because of things they did wrong, but because they had stumbled into investigations that implicated powerful people. I think that's very, very dangerous. I mean, one of the things that is chilling to me is when President Truman himself caves to that kind of pressure and decides to submarine this information rather than expose it to the American public. And then it is hidden for a decade and a half before anybody finds out what had been discovered by this Justice Department investigation. I mean, I do feel like there's things that we did wrong.
And to be clear, this was a Justice Department investigation that took place when the case had been mothballed. The prosecutor who just happens to speak native German, picks up and goes across the ocean and starts interviewing senior Nazis who have not yet been executed, and comes up with just a remarkable abundance of human and documentary source intelligence about the German side of these operations that he'd been prosecuting in this mothballed case. Is that a fair summary?
Absolutely. Yeah. He was looking, one of the allegations in the Great Sedition Trial was that this was a conspiracy that involved all these Americans here with the German government. And it's one thing to allege that from here, looking across the ocean at the German government, but then once the war ends, to be able to go to Germany and document their side of that conspiracy to get corroborating information, both from Nazi war crime defendants and also from the German Foreign Office files. Just a remarkable thing to be able to do in a prosecutorial context. He did it under the understanding that the result of that investigation, even if the trial was not brought again, they were at a mistrial, so they had to decide whether to bring it back up. He did it with the understanding with the attorney general that he would be able to make a report to the public about his findings. When he brought his findings back, the attorney general reneged on that. And then the attorney general and President Truman said that his report would never see the light of day. Now, it did. It took 15 years. In 1961, he was able to publish a version of it as a private citizen. But by then, the political sort of import of it, I think, was lost for decades, maybe until now.
So before we turn to the villains of this story, I just want to ask about this urge in the mid-40s now. So the United States has been at war with Germany since 1941. These are discredited figures. Some of them still have positions, but these are not, as you say, these are people whose star has fallen at this point. And yet, one of the defendants is in 1944, Sieg Heiling on the steps of the courthouse.
Yeah.
And apparently, proudly and unashamedly, they are, and the Justice Department, even after the war, is worried enough to deep six this report and to essentially drop the case. And my question is, I can kind of understand that in the 30s, but now we've just like invaded Germany, we've decapitated this regime. The story of who this regime is now very well known. What is the reticence on the part of Attorney General and future Supreme Court Justice Tom Clark and and the sainted Harry Truman, who, by the way, is the president who recognizes the State of Israel, and he's the guy who ends the war by dropping the bomb. These are not faint-hearted people in the anti-fascist department, and yet they're kind of quivering in fear of the public reaction to these spent domestic fascist forces. I'm curious why you think that happened. Was that just residual political power?
It was because there were so many members of Congress and senators who were implicated. So the Justice Department charged congressional staffers for who had been involved with this Nazi agent in this big propaganda plot. They brought a few members of Congress in against their will to testify to the grand jury, but they never charged members of Congress or United States senators. I believe, as a non-lawyer, looking at what they were looking at the people they did charge, I think there was absolutely a case to charge Hamilton Fish, absolutely a case to charge Senator Ernest Lundeen had he survived, although he died in 1940 in a plane crash. There were the members of Congress who had their staffers charged. They themselves could have been, I believe, could have been charged themselves, but they were never charged. And then in 1944, when the judge dies in the middle of this chaotic, out of control sedition trial, and the Justice
Department, which, by the way, was the only rational response to what was going on in his courtroom.
Yes, exactly. Yes. Strong point, Judge Eicher. Strong point. I can't argue with you there. You went home 7 months into the trial and just died. But when the Justice Department had to decide whether or not to bring this case again, the Supreme Court by then had decided a number of First Amendment cases that made even John Rogge, the prosecutor, believe that they had a worse chance than they had at the outset of getting convictions. But the submarining of Rogge's report and the firing of Rogge from the Justice Department and the unwillingness to make any of this known to the public was absolutely about it being too close to American power. And I think part of that may have been that people like Wheeler were throwing their weight around. Wheeler was had the ear of the president. Wheeler had already succeeded in getting one attorney general, Francis Biddle, to fire another prosecutor, William Power Maloney, on this same case. But the other part of it, by 1946, by the time Rogge got back from Germany, was, hey, listen, the story, Truman never explained himself, so I'm surmising this of my own, out of my own brain. But, you know, the story there was that we were the good guys and the Nazis were the bad guys. And we, the good guys, went over there and won and dispatched them from the earth. And now we are going to take on our role as the sole superpower in the world and square off against the Soviet Union and make sure that the world is safe for democracy. And by the way, we need to rebuild Europe on the way. I mean, he was like, we have bigger fish to fry. The idea that we would then also need, as a public, to contend with 24 members of Congress and the U.S. Senate, having been part of what they knew was a Nazi project inside the U.S. government, it just wasn't, I think, a narrative that he wanted to engage in. It wasn't a public, you know, expository project that he wanted to have to do. I can sympathize with the sort of impulse. We see it in lots of presidents, right, who don't want to deal with the deep, ugly consequences of the behavior of U.S. officials under previous administrations. But every time you let something like that slide, it just atrophies our muscles for being able to confront it when it rolls around again.
Yeah. So let's, with all of that as a giant prologue, let's turn to the plot itself. Which is where a normal person, I think, would have started this interview. But I like to start with democratic antibodies before we get to fascist disease. One of the interesting things about the book is the claim, which I really hadn't known, that this propaganda effort started essentially the moment Hitler came to power, and that the sense of the United States as a propaganda battleground was quite organic to the Nazi regime. So let's start with the highest altitude villain here, which is Hitler himself, and probably in functional terms, more Goebbels, the propaganda ministry. What were they trying to achieve in the United States?
What they were trying to achieve was really, I think, three things. One, the smallest of them, was to activate the German-American population, the German-American diaspora in the United States, which is large, to effectively side with Germany to become an important political force in the United States and trying to keep the United States from allying itself against German interests in the war. That was kind of, I think, their smallest project. Their sort of medium-sized project was to support and encourage and add fuel to what was the very widely held belief in the United States, which is that the United States should not enter the war. In the wake of World War I, the American public had zero appetite for getting involved in another European war. In 1940, some public polling showed that as many as 83% of the U.S. public did not want us to be involved in what by then was very clearly World War II. So they just wanted to add whatever they could to the isolationist side of the argument in domestic U.S. politics. But then I think their biggest project was to soften us up as a society and as a democracy, to make the American public disbelieve what they derided as atrocity stories about Nazism and about Germans, to feel at least curious, if not positive, about fascism as a potential form of government, and to feel dissatisfied with democracy as our own system of government, to make us feel like democracy was corrupt, that our own government shouldn't be trusted, that people like President Roosevelt were actually secretly being controlled by the Jews or by other international forces and not acting in the interests of the American public. And that was to make us weak and divided, but also to potentially soften us up for either a takeover by an invading force or a takeover by native fascist forces that would ally the U.S. with Germany rather than against them. So they were operating at a number of different levels, and they were committed from the very first days of Hitler's government in Berlin to really spending whatever it took to propagandize the American public as aggressively as they propagandized any other public in the world.
Yeah. So it seems to me from the book, they had basically three instruments with which they were doing that. One was and they were integrated, of course, with one another, but one was a very respectable campaign by domestic civil society organizations like the America First Committee that were led by genuinely American figures like, Senator Lundeen and Charles Lindbergh. The second is the seeding of fascist thinkers and sometimes just violent terrorist organizations. And then the third was these random investments in weird grifters. the sort of, I have an idea, I want to be the Führer. And the Germans, catch wind of it and they kind of invite you to Berlin. And, maybe you're nobody. You're just kind of in it, but you've proclaimed yourself the next Führer. And they seem to have a venture capital-like approach to such people, which is kind of invest in all of them and see what happens. Some of these people have drifted into obscurity, George Sylvester Viereck. But some of them, like Father Coughlin, are kind of legendary names in particularly the history of anti-Semitism, Henry Ford, of course. But and so I'm curious, was this a coordinated strategy? They're like, all right, we're going to get our congressional people. We're going to get our, our lunatic grifters. We're going to have some terrorists. Was this just different parts of the German government throwing money at different elements of American society?
It's a really good question, and it's one of the things that actually Raggi tried to untangle when he went over to Germany in 1946 and went through their records to figure out, was this all emanating from the same part of the Nazi government? Was this a point of contention in the German government? Were there different elements? And it turns out it's as complex as it would be in any other large organization trying to do a big, complex, covert operation like this. But you're right that they were investing in all sorts of different levels. Like, for example, there's a guy who features heavily in the book whose name is George Detheridge, which is this great name. But he sort of embodies this. He gets brought over to Germany, to Erfurt, Germany, in the 30s to speak at what the Nazis were then organizing as an annual World Conference of Anti-Semites. Oh, great. That's a thing that we needed in the world. But he was one of the first Americans to ever address a large Nazi gathering when he was invited, along with a number of other Americans, to address that gathering. He went home and founded something called the American Nationalist Confederation, which used as its emblem the Nazi swastika. And he tried, with support from Germany, from the German government, ongoing contact with the Nazis in Berlin, he tried to organize what would effectively be an umbrella organization of U.S. fascist groups to work together toward what they hoped would be a violent overthrow of the U.S. government. They had their new Führer picked out. It was going to be the deputy chief of staff of the U.S. Army, George Van Horn Mosley. They had united all of these groups under the basic plan of how they were going to set off terroristic cell violence in the wake of what they expected to be an electoral disappointment that would upset isolationist-minded Americans. Detheridge was in regular consultation with the German embassy in Washington. So it was, he wasn't a German. He wasn't somebody who was sent over from Germany to be a spy here. He was a native-born American fascist, but working in close consultation with the Germans to bring about the kind of change that they wanted to see, the kind of organizing they wanted to be able to build on in the United States. He's ultimately one of the sedition trial defendants who's let off.
It seems to me that – so he was basically a nobody when he goes over to the World Congress of Anti-Semites. You might say he is roughly like, Carter Page. That is a self-described intellectual who is sympathetic to the authoritarian, or in that case, totalitarian foreign government, and kind of wanders over and they welcome him and kind of invest in him. And when we see somebody like Carter Page, you know, the defense of him is always, well, he was kind of a weird fish and a nobody. But of course, Putin does invite him to give these speeches, and he's not treated that way either by the Trump campaign or by the Russians. And I was thinking about him when I was reading about George Dethridge, which is like, okay, you pronounce yourself a fascist theoretician who has grand ambitions, and the fascists come find you. Shouldn't that make us wary when we see somebody, oh, say Carter Page, you know, declare himself a important conduit between Russia and the United States, and somebody who's going to explain Russian policy, and the Russians then invest in him? It seems to me you don't really know whether you're dealing with a George Dethridge or a Carter Page until you follow up on it.
Yeah, and you don't know what's ultimately going to become of them, right? I mean, the thing about sedition prosecutions, right, inherently is that if you're charged with trying to overthrow the government has put you on trial for that, which means you didn't succeed in overthrowing the government, which means that inherently you can argue, your defense can be, oh, this wasn't serious. Oh, I'm just a goofball. Oh, I'm just a crackpot. I'm nobody, because it didn't work. And for all of these guys, like the decision you sort of have to come up against over and over again, as much in history as you do in our current day, is stupid or dangerous. And the answer I have finally learned now that I'm 50 years old is the answer to stupid or dangerous is yes. It is not an either or situation. And you never know whether the George Dethridge figure or the Charles Coughlin figure or the William Dudley Pelley figure or any of the other people who you could dismiss as crackpots as you wanted to, were ever going to ascend to a point where they could actually effectuate their plans or have real influence. I mean, who would have thought that Donald Trump would not only win the Republican nomination, but win the presidency? Like, it was very, very, very easy. It's even still today hard sometimes to take him seriously as a figure of global import. But yet, here we are. And I think the investment by hostile foreign powers in people who might seem ridiculous at the outset is kind of a VC strategy. A bunch of these people will end up being cheap to us and of no account. But that also has its own benefit, because then we can use their clownishness to downplay the importance of our investment.
And just to be clear, neither of us are making any allegations about Mr. Page.
Not at all.
So it seems to me three of the VC recipients, though, pay off in spades. You do kind of, looking at them in retrospect, say, okay, well, that was a win. For the Nazis. One is Virik, who runs this incredible operation with these members of Congress. Another is Coughlin, who becomes one of the most important figures in U.S. media history, just in terms of his reach. Mm-hmm. And the third is the Coughlin spinoff group, which is the Christian Front, which seems to me important because it amasses a significant amount of weaponry. And just as an old counterterrorism guy, one of the big differences between the people who were dangerous and the people who are not dangerous is explosives.
Yes.
It's a good rule.
Good rule of thumb.
Do you have explosives? That's a big binary check mark. So I wanna ask you about each of them. Virik, the story of Virik and his relationship with a U.S. senator who conveniently dies. It's a remarkable story, and it's a story that makes me wonder which of our current officials, you know, it raises the collusion question, right? Mm-hmm. When somebody sounds like the Nazi government, maybe it's because the Nazi government is paying him to say those things. When somebody sounds like a spokesman for Vladimir Putin, it just raises that question. And so just for those who have not yet read the book, walk us through what Viereck was doing with more than 20 members of the House and Senate.
So we'll take Senator Lundeen, the senator who died in the plane crash, as the example here. So Lundeen was definitely isolationist in his outlook. He had been against the U.S. joining World War I. He, in fact, had lost his seat in the House because of that, but then had come back and become a senator, and was a very, very strident isolationist voice against us getting involved in World War II. He was also a real creep and corrupt. And one of the ways we know that is that when his Senate staff would be paid every week, he would demand from them cash kickbacks. So they would have to hand over to him a portion of their weekly salary in cash, and they wouldn't get a receipt. And that was part of what it meant to work for Ernest Lundeen. He was just he was a scumbag. Forgive me for saying it. So in those terms, I've been looking for a long time to find other nice things to say about Senator Lundeen to give a more balanced portrayal of him.
Some people are just bad.
I have yet to find a lot of good things to say about Ernest Lundeen. So Viereck had been actually in contact with him for a long time, going back to his World War I isolationist days. And in World War II, he hit upon this idea that Lundeen, who seemed to be money motivated, could be persuaded not just to continue to advance his isolationist line, which Germany favored, but instead to get more specific about it and actually to put his name on things that were authored in Germany and by Viereck as a German agent, if he could be paid for doing so. And so they entered into a mutually beneficial arrangement where Viereck would bring to him German propaganda, Lundeen would put his name on it, they would have it published in magazines or newspapers for money, and they would split the funds. Or more often, Lundeen would deliver it either as a speech or insert it into the congressional record. And then Viereck would pay for there to be gazillions of copies of that made at a discounted government printing rate, and then it would be sent out under Lundeen's congressional franc, so sent out without postage, with the taxpayers paying the postage all over the country. So it was both money-making scheme and also essentially a free mouthpiece, free speech-writing scheme for Lundeen. It was very efficient, very satisfying to the German Foreign Office, we know from German records. And when Lundeen was such a success, Viereck then expanded from Lundeen to lots of other members of Congress. Hamilton Fish was the worst in the House. And they ran what ultimately was a multi-million dollar effort, which sent out millions of pieces of German authored propaganda at government cost, at taxpayer expense, to American homes.
So what about Coughlin? It seems to me he's a figure with perhaps the most immediate contemporary analog.
Coughlin is, for me, I feel like he's like the way I calibrate my scale in terms of thinking about whether there are modern doppelgangers for these historical figures. Like, clearly we have a very influential, very right-wing media apparatus that has a really important role to play in reactionary politics in this country today. We have no Charles Coughlin right today. Like, he's got 30 million weekly listeners by some counts by the late 1930s, at a time when there are way fewer than 200 million people living in the country. I mean, he's got basically a quarter of the country listening to him at some times. While he is saying, I take the road of fascism, while he is saying we need to follow the Franco way, what he calls the Franco way in this country, meaning we need a military dictatorship, while he is organizing his followers into armed paramilitary cells to pursue a fascist takeover of the U.S. government. I mean, to have that wide a reach and that radical a message is something that I think there are pretenders to that throne today. And there are pretenders to that throne in your and my lifetimes in terms of watching the right. But he was of an order of magnitude different in terms of his reach and influence and his radicalism and therefore his dangerousness.
So I'm going to ask you two more questions and then let you go.
Okay.
The first is one thing that is doppelganger-y about this period when you read about it in your book versus now is just how corrupt everybody is. That everybody from the America First Committee, which is burning trash in burning its records in trash barrels, to the senator who's taking kickbacks from his staff, to, you know, Pelley, who's, you know, just going from one publishing grift to another.
Everybody, to Coughlin, too, who's becoming immensely personally rich.
Real estate.
As a serving Catholic priest, right?
Right.
I mean, he's a gazillionaire by the time the Catholic Church finally shuts down his radio show.
Is there something inherent about the relationship between populist authoritarianism and simple grifting corruption?
Yes.
I think there is.
There is. And it is logical, right? I mean, if you want to, in a democratic system of government, with a free press and an independent judiciary, people who grift, you know, people who commit fraud, people who use their public office for corrupt purposes are exposed and prosecuted. And even if they're not prosecuted, they're held to account by an informed democratic polity that has the opportunity to reject them at the polls if they are shown to be criminally inclined or morally suspect. That's no good if
right.
What you're after is the ability to commit crimes and steal with impunity. It would be much better if that's your inclination in public life to be in a strongman form of government where it matters who you are and whose side you're on and you get to take what you want with impunity. I mean, I have learned a lot on this front from Alexei Navalny and his organization in Russia in terms of the way they have centered corruption in their analysis of what happened to Russia's proto-democracy and what Russians' day-to-day suffering is in living under a dictatorship like Putin's. It is, you know, corruption is hand in glove with authoritarian government, with strongman government, as it has always been. And I think there's a profound truth to that.
One of the very upsetting things about the book, and I want to leave this here, is that some of the good guys die in total obscurity. And some of the bad guys, including Father Coughlin, you know, who gets shut up by his diocese in 1942, but who has a million in real estate and dies a very rich man in 1979, having never been stripped of his priesthood. I mean, this is a bunch of these people who are the bad guys go on to essentially unrepentant lives. And, you know, you note about the Washington Post reporter whose name is escaping me that when
Dillard Stokes,
that when he died, he got a very modest obituary. And you say sort of plaintively, he deserved better. What should we make of the fact that, you know, there is no justice here, just in the karmic sense of what happens to Leon Lewis and Dillard Stokes and John Raji, who's, you know, the head of the criminal division and at the beginning of the book and dies in obscurity at the end of the book. And that, you know, we have a famous fascist architect and a very rich Father Coughlin and a 95-year-old terrorist who's giving unrepented, joins the bar in Brooklyn finally at 90 or whatever. What do we make of the cosmic karmic injustices here?
Yeah, and I would add to this that George Dethridge goes on to be kind of a thing in Republican politics. And some of the some of the William Langer's another senator who plays a sort of devious role in all of this, and he ends up playing a disgusting role in this effort to try to send Black Americans to Africa against their will. I mean, these guys go on. He's one of the people that isn't voted out. There is a level of cosmic injustice in this story that I feel like I'm working on. I am trying to make Henry Hoke famous, the ad man who exposed the propaganda plot in Congress out of his own private sector investigations. I'm trying to make John Rogge a hero in the U.S. Justice Department and not somebody who got fired for cutting cross purposes with an attorney general who went on to the Supreme Court. I'm trying to make that episode in Harry Truman's presidency where he decided to submarine this, something that is seen as a black mark on his presidency and not something that is forgotten. I'm trying to make Leon Lewis as famous as I can possibly make him. He died not long after this episode, running this spy ring. He died in a car crash on the Pacific Coast Highway, and his obituary mentioned none of this heroism. I want these heroes, Dillard Stokes and all the rest of them. I want this heroism to be known. And even if it wasn't known in their lifetime, I want us to learn from it. I feel like they did something that was a huge contribution in their time. It is also a huge contribution in our time, as long as we're willing to learn it. I also, you know, listen, I work in the news business. I spend a lot of time every day thinking about, working on, reporting on, and explaining the doings of the worst people in America and the worst people in the world. It is also worth not letting those people be lost to history and holding them to account too. The long tail of Philip Johnson, the long tail of Charles Coughlin, the long tail of George Dethridge is a tail that should have been stepped on by a public that was.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince? They exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Better informed about their villainy. And I am invested in that too, and I'm invested in that for today's doppelgangers, for those bad guys.
We are going to leave it there. It's a great place to end. Rachel, thank you so much for joining us today.
Ben, this was so fun. Thank you for the close read of the book and all your thoughts on it. This is a really stimulating conversation for me. I really appreciate it.
That was Chatter, a production of Lawfare and Goat Rodeo. Please subscribe to the podcast and find us on Twitter at That Was Chatter.